nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so I'm Steve Worley. I'm a professor in mechanical engineering, and my expertise is in fluid mechanics. And today I'm going to be talking about what is nanofluidics. And I added a little bit of a cranky title, the nanoizing of fluid mechanics. So we'll talk about whether or not that's appropriate, or under what circumstances is it appropriate to put nano in fluid mechanics. Okay, an introduction. Aside from this being a commercial, or this isn't just a commercial for my book, but it's actually a citation. So a lot of the references that you'll see, a lot of the figures that you'll see in this presentation come out of the book. And this second edition is due out later this year. All right. So what we did in the second edition was we tried to come up with a definition for microfluidics. And so the working definition that my co-author and I came up with is the science and engineering of systems in which fluid behavior differs from conventional flow theory primarily due to the small length scale of the system. So primarily due to the small length scale of the system, that's important. So it's not just looking at smaller flows, but it's looking at flows which behave differently because they're small. So that's an important distinction. So some of the assessing the interest level in microfluidics. These are figures again out of the second edition of my book. On the left, I've got millions. So I've got the worldwide market quantified in millions of U.S. dollars, starting from 98 through 2003. So those are actual numbers, and then what you can't see there is a projection for through 2008, and the growth rate is projected to be, in this market, is projected to be 15.5% annually through 2008. So if you can find a stock that's going to return 15% annually, you should invest in that stock. This is a hot area. It's growing fast. So that's commercial interest. Academic interest you can assess by quantifying or by measuring the number of papers that have been published recently. And so these are all real numbers, not projected numbers. Starting from, there were a few papers trickling along in the, probably since the late 1800s, talking about microfluid mechanics, small length scale effects in fluids. But lately, we've seen this this sharp upturn in the number of papers published, and that's driven by the funding environment. It's also driven by the fact that there have been journals established, in which the topic is microfluidics. JMEMS and Journal of Micromechanics and Microengineering. Micro-nanofluidics, those are all journals that have been established relatively recently and have as a significant part of their activities fluid mechanics. So this was a day-long project for a grad student at UC Santa Barbara, just going and finding all of these journal publications. So start off with the definition of a fluid. A fluid is a substance that deforms continuously under the application of a shear stress. And in particular, since this is for a more general audience, the difference between a fluid and an elastic solid is if I push on an elastic solid and I release that force that I'm pushing on it with, it comes back to its equilibrium position. If I do the same kind of thing with a fluid, let's say I dye a chunk of fluid yellow in this case, in between two parallel plates, and I push one of the parallel plates, the fluid deforms just like you would see with the solid. But in contrast, if I take off the force, that's the new equilibrium position of the fluid, that chunk of fluid. And so So that's the fundamental difference between fluids and solids. There is no elasticity. Liquids become less viscous as temperature increases, and gases become more viscous as temperature increases. We can say a little bit about that as we go on. We're going to talk about the molecular nature of fluids in a little bit. Actually, one important point from the previous page is that both liquids and gases are fluids. And so if you say fluid, you mean either a liquid or a gas, or both. But fluid doesn't mean liquid, and that's a common misconception in fluid in for people who aren't fluids experts. Now, so there's a couple of reasons why you can get behavior changes as the length scale becomes small. And the first is strictly a scaling phenomenon. So it's called the cube square law. At least that's what engineers call it. And it says that quantities that vary like the cube of a length scale, so things like buoyancy and inertia, those become small faster than things that vary like the square of a length scale. And so things that vary like the square of a length scale are drag, surface charge. The square of a length scale is area. So anything that varies like an area gets small slower than things that vary like the volume. So that's in a nutshell the cube square law. It says, you know, at small length scales you expect surface forces to be more important than volume forces. Now, even more important at small length scales is things that vary like the in proportion to length scale, and so that would be surface tension. That's really the only good example is surface tension. And so surface tension is a huge mover at small length scales. And if you get if you build a nanometer or micron scale device and you get a bubble in it, you're pretty much done for, unless you can figure out some way to evaporate the liquid out and start over. But evaporation is notoriously slow in diffusion dominated domains. So the cube square law, that's strictly continuum fluid mechanics. Everything we know about fluid mechanics at the large length scale applies. This is assuming everything that we know at large length scales applies at small length scales. And we'll see in a minute that that's true for things, anything above somewhere in the ballpark to 10 nanometers to a micron. If you're larger than that, you can use this cube square law to predict the dominance of different terms. But these are all physical phenomena that we're well aware of. Now, another thing that we need to worry about as we talk about length scale becoming small is the whole continuum assumption breaking down. So, you know, one of the fundamental assumptions in fluid mechanics is that the flow behaves like a continuum. The fluid behaves like a continuum. It's an undifferentiated chunk of stuff that responds like fluids do, shear when you apply a stress to it. And so at some length scale, below some length scale, that the molecular nature of the fluid is going to become apparent, and it's going to behave differently from at large length scales. And so we need to assess what's that threshold. And we need to know where that happens and what happens when we go below that length scale. So in gases, this theory is really well established by Boltzmann and others starting in the late 1800s. So using a dimensionless parameter called the Knudsen number, you can quantify how coarse or how granular the flow seems through any geometry. And so for small Knudsen numbers, you get continuum flow. As the Knudsen number gets larger, as it gets up to 10 to the minus 3, 0.01, we lose what's called the no-slip condition. That starts to fail. And as it gets larger than about 0.1, the whole continuum assumption itself fails. And so that's the route to continuum failure in gas, and that's really well established. It's based on kinetic gas theory. In liquids, things are much more complicated, and that's because gases largely consist of molecules that are flying around in straight lines and enjoy brief energetic collisions with each other. Liquids, on the other hand, the molecules are right up against each other, rubbing together, and makes for very much more complicated dynamics, and complicated things can happen. So we'll have to talk further about what, you know, what is the nature of this complexity. All right, so so the first thing that we might want to do is figure out what is a length scale, what is the length scale that's going to divide between the continuum world, where I can use scaling relations and everything that I know about fluid mechanics at large length scales, from the discontinuous molecular world. And that line is necessarily dependent on whether you're using, or whether you're talking about liquids or gases. So I've got gases on the left, something diatomic. You can think this could be just about anything. N2O2, something like that. Doesn't really matter. Sizes don't change a whole lot. And liquids, I've drawn something that looks like a little cartoon of liquid water. Think about both of these as being at standard conditions. So the molecular diameter in both cases, and I'm rounding here, I'm taking some liberties with the exact numbers, but I'm rounding here so that the size of the molecules is not considerably different in either case. What is different is the number of molecules that you have, let's say, per cubic meter. So that's called the number density. So the number density of molecules in a gas is about 1,000 times less, or 1/1,000th of that in a liquid. That's the real big difference between liquids and gases. So that would be, you know, so you'd have 1,000 times more in a box of a given size of a liquid than a gas. Now, if in order to assess whether I have continuum flow or discontinuous flow, I need to figure out how far apart are the molecules. Well, that's pretty easy to do. If you know how many are in a box, you can just take the inverse cube root of that number concentration, and you get the average spacing. So if I do that for the gas, I get an average spacing of 3 nanometers. And if I do that for a liquid, I get an average spacing of 0.4 nanometers. So that's an important number. That tells me how coarse, or on what length scale is the fluid coarse. On what length scale are will the molecules become apparent? Another important quantity that we need to know about in small scale flows is how far does a molecule have to go to bump into a neighbor? Now, you know, and that seems like that's redundant. If I say how far does a molecule have to go to bump into a neighbor, it seems like, you know, why isn't it just 3 nanometers? Well, if you think about it, if these molecules are point-sized, if they're geometric points with no physical size, they're never going to bump into each other. So there's what's called a scattering cross-section, which is related to the size of the molecule. And so bigger molecules will have a shorter distance that they need to go to bump into each other. And so for gases, this displacement distance, so I'm calling this displacement distance. In gases, we have a particular name for that, and it's called the mean free path. But I'm using displacement distance as a generic term for how far does a molecule have to go to bump into a neighbor. In a gas, it's on the order of 100 nanometers, gas at STP. And in a liquid, it's something like a picometer. And this is really poorly defined because the potential, the intermolecular potential, tails off. It's difficult to say if one molecule is actually touching another. I mean, when you start talking about molecules, you can't really say, you know, touching in a conventional sense. But something like a picometer is a good estimate of how far a molecule has to go to bump into a neighbor without getting too balled up on the details of what does bump into mean. The molecular velocity is not something that's significantly different for liquids and gases, and that's because it's largely from kinetic energy. And so that means it's temperature-based, and it's pretty much the same case, pretty much the same whether you're talking about a liquid or a gas. So there's a little difference, but not much. It's not what governs the difference in behavior between the two. All right, so we need to remember these two numbers, intermolecular spacing and displacement distance. So if I do a If I want to talk about whether a fluid is continuous or not, I need to know, are the point quantities continuous and are the interaction quantities continuous? So point quantities are things that in conventional fluid mechanics we talk about as being defined at points. Things like density, velocity, temperature. So in conventional fluid mechanics, after the first day of class, when you initially make some arguments that fluids, although they're composed of molecules, we can treat them as continua. After you get done with that, we never go back to thinking about fluids as comprised of molecules. And we talk about properties being defined at points. And so those are the kinds of quantities. So these point quantities, they need to be taken over. They're actually averages over small regions of space, and they need to be. It needs to be a large enough region of space that those point quantities don't behave in a statistically behave statistically poorly. Let's say they don't oscillate around a lot. And so we could do a thought experiment for what is that length scale. If you imagine a box that measures L on a side, that volume of that box is L cubed. And so if I imagine calculating the density of the fluid in that box for a small number of molecules, I can imagine that there's some handful of molecules in that box. And if I'm down here on this axis, going from left to right, making the box go from small to large, what's going to happen is I'll have some small number of molecules in the box, and then let's say I've got three there, and then I add a fourth molecule, so the density goes up. Density is just number of the molecules times the mass of each molecule over the volume of the box. So I add, let's say, a fourth molecule, the density jumps up, then I make the box bigger and bigger, and as I make it bigger and bigger, the density is gradually decreasing until I get, let's say, add another molecule, the density jumps up, and so on, and eventually those oscillations stabilize. And those oscillations stabilize when I have a statistically significant number of molecules in the box such that adding a new molecule doesn't cause a significant change in the density. So in engineering, we love to make approximations, and we could say, how about if I say I want less than 1% variations in the property? Well, statistical random process theory tells us that you can get 1% accuracy if you have a box that contains 10,000 molecules. Well, if you go to the previous page where I talked about how many molecules are in a box, it's easy to figure out how big is that box. That box in a gas is 70 nanometers on a side, and in a liquid is 8 nanometers on a side. Okay, so those are point quantities. So those need to be continuous in order for the fluid to be continuous. But I also need another type of quantity that's very important in fluid mechanics, and that's called interaction quantities. And so interaction quantities are things like viscosity, thermal conductivity, and diffusivity. Those all are defined only, they're only defined when you have a large number of molecules, and they involve the molecules rubbing on each other and dissipating energy or transmitting energy. So in a gas, the length scale that tells me how many interactions I can get in a box is the mean free path. So that was the 100 nanometer number from a couple pages ago, one page ago. And in a liquid, it's not how far, if I want to know how many interactions, how many molecular interactions I can fit in a box, it's not the distance the molecules have to go that's important. That was the 0.4 picometers. It's the number of molecules. Because if each molecule is 0.3 nanometers, if each molecule is 0.3 nanometers, and the displacement distance here is 1 picometer, that's about 1% of the molecular diameter. Right, so each molecule, you can think about each fluid molecule, each liquid molecule, as just vibrating in place very slightly, 1% of its diameter. So if I want to know how many interactions I'm going to get in a box, the picometer number isn't the number I use. It's the molecular diameter, or maybe the molecular spacing. I mean, and that doesn't matter a whole lot because it's either 0.3 or 0.4 nanometers, whichever you choose. Now, this isn't a real well-motivated part of this argument, but this is what everybody says, including Dean, but also Batchelor and so forth. They make an argument that you need to have 10 interaction length scales in each direction, X, Y, and Z, in order for the transport quantity to behave continuously in X, Y, and Z. And so that's 10 cubed is 1,000. The box that contains 1,000 of these molecules is 1 micron for a gas and 3 nanometers for a liquid. So if I take the max of these quantities with the quantities from the previous page and round liberally, I find that 1 micron for gases and 10 nanometers for liquids is a good rough estimate of where is this transition between continuum behavior and molecular behavior. Now, this is very rough, and it varies depending on the type of liquid or gas, the type of molecule that you're considering. And so if you're using something that's very different from diatomic gas, or very different in size from water, like, say, a hydrocarbon, these numbers might be significantly larger or smaller. I guess they're not going to get a whole lot smaller. They just can't. But they could get considerably larger. If you're talking about liquid crystals or DNA or something, these numbers could get considerably larger. All right, so once you make this decision of whether you have a continuum flow or discontinuous flow, then you can decide how are you going to solve a fluids problem. And so that decision, or that the decision of whether it's continuum or discontinuous, tells me if I'm going to be on the left-hand side or the right-hand side of this figure. If I decide I have a continuum flow, I'm going to proceed down the right-hand side of this figure. And this is something like 150 years of experience on that side of the tree. developing the full governing equations are called the Navier-Stokes equations. The equations that are usually used in small-scale flows are called the Stokes equations, which are a simplification of the Navier-Stokes equations. And they're relatively easy to solve. The linear PDE, relatively easy to solve. If you decide that you're on the left-hand side in the molecular domain, then things are considerably more difficult. Even at their easiest, they're considerably more difficult. So as I'm going down the molecular side of things, I have to choose between deterministic and statistical models of fluids. And if I choose deterministic, there's a measurement technique called molecular dynamics that we'll talk about, and a simulation technique called molecular dynamics that we'll talk about in just a second. That's a real workhorse that's being used a lot today. It's a very useful technique, but it's very computationally expensive. And then if I come down the statistical side, I run into what's called the Liouville equation. And under that, there are a couple of different domains or different ranges for that equation. And one can be solved using a technique called direct simulation Monte Carlo, and the other using Boltzmann methods. So I'm not going to talk about either of those today. It's not really my thing. And the molecular dynamics is providing some very nice results of late. So molecular dynamics is essentially applying Newton's second law to molecules and how the molecules interact with each other. And the way that you do that is, with Newton's second law, you have inertia, and that's balanced by applied forces. So the applied forces in this case, if you're thinking about a box full of molecules, the applied forces could be the molecules banging into the wall. It could also be the molecules influencing each other. And so you need there's electrostatic influences of one, from one molecule to another. And you need a model for how that behavior works in order to do any sort of calculations. So one of the most popular models is called the Leonard Jones potential, and it's also called the 612 potential. The 612 potential, for reasons you'll see in a second, and basically it says that the potential energy between any two molecules, so I've labeled those I and J here, potential energy between the ith molecule and the jth molecule is just given by an algebraic expression of the radius, or the distance between the molecule centers, in taken to the minus 12th and the minus 6th power, with the right constants multiplying it. So that's potential energy. If I take the derivative of potential energy with respect to position, then I get force. So this equation over here is force. So this is now a model for how two molecules influence each other. And I've graphically represented this in the lower right figure, where I'm plotting the vertical axis is in arbitrary units. And the horizontal axis is separation distance, plotted at like R over sigma. And sigma happens to be effectively the molecular diameter, something like the effective molecular diameter. And so what I'm plotting is two things. I'm plotting the potential energy here and the potential force. And I've normalized both of them so that they're dimensionless, by the right scales, I can make these dimensionless. So this is something like a general purpose plot of the Leonard Jones potential, applicable for anywhere Leonard Jones is applicable. You could use this chart. And so the force is the dashed line, and the dashed line, it starts out at large separations as a very small interaction potential and then decreases to a minimum value. And this is the attractive portion of the Leonard Jones potential. And then it increases sharply. And so what's going on there is when the molecules are separated by a large distance, they exert almost no force on each other. And that's because you've got a minus 6 and a minus 12 power of radius. So those forces taper off very fast. As the molecules come close to each other, the van der Waals, which is the minus 6 portion of the 612 potential, they start to attract molecules toward each other. Once the molecules get close enough to each other that the electron clouds start interfering, then if I try to push them closer together, they push back really sharply. So the van der Waals, the minus 6 part of this model, is can be analytically derived. The minus 12 part is phenomenological, and it has to do with the Pauli exclusion principle. But you can't, using quantum mechanics, derive that minus 12. It doesn't come out of any analysis. It's just phenomenological. All right. So once you have a model for how the molecules interact, then you can just use Newton's second law. And so what I have here is the mass of a molecule times the second derivative of position. So that's acceleration. And it's balanced on the right-hand side by the applied force. So the derivative, I've written that out as the derivative of the potential, but you recall from the previous page, that's just the force. Now, for the purposes of this discussion, just ignore these other two terms on the right-hand side. So those are kind of fine points that you don't really need to know about to understand the concept of molecular dynamics. So the important thing about molecular dynamics is it's Newton's second law. And theoretically, this is really easy to solve. I mean, I can write this out on a piece of paper. If you give me two molecules, I can write this out on a piece of paper, and I can tell you, if you tell me where they are and how fast they're moving, I can tell you where they're going to be tomorrow. It's just that easy. The problem is, nobody cares about two molecules. Right? You want to know what a billion molecules are doing. And, I mean, if we go back to the number density from a couple pages ago and you figure out how many molecules are in a 1 micron cube. So 1 micron cube, we said molecules are something like 3/10 of a nanometer. So that's something like 3,000 in a micron. And if I cube that, 3,000, that's about 27 billion. 27 billion molecules of a liquid in a 1 micron cube. So that number is prohibitively large. If you ask anybody who does computational fluid dynamics how many degrees of freedom they can have in their model, you might get an answer like a couple hundred thousand or a million. And if you ask them, can you do 27 billion, they're going to laugh at you. So nobody does flows that are that big yet. Molecular dynamics is not to the point where we can do macro-scale flows using a micro-scale approach. But it's really good for doing flows over small things like carbon nanotubes, and we'll take a look at that in a second. So so one thing, the numbers are against you. Just the numbers of molecules are against you in molecular dynamics. The other thing is you need to chop the time steps. As you integrate in time, you need to chop the time steps very finely. And so the size of the time steps is given by this expression here, this tau expression, which is just a combination of the size of the molecule, the mass of the molecule, and the energy of the molecule. And I can arrange those units as they are here to have dimensions of time. And so if I arrange them like that and I plug in, let's say, typical values for argon, which is a molecule that people use a lot with molecular dynamics because it's a nice, simple molecule, that number turns out to be 2 times 10 to the minus 12. So that number, that time scale, that is a characteristic time scale for one molecule interacting with another. Think of it as a collision time. So that collision time is 10 to the minus 12 seconds. And you need to chop up your time steps in your integration much, much smaller than that. So think 2 to 3 orders of magnitude smaller than that. So now if I want to know what's going on 1 second from now in my fluid, I need to do something like 2 times 10 to the minus 14 or 15 calculations, or sorry, 2 times 10 to the 15 calculations. That's a lot of calculations. So the numbers are really against us, and you have to be very clever and very conservative with how you scale down your problems. So fortunately, there are people around who are doing these types of calculations. So we'll see a little bit about that on the next page. But before we look at the next page, this is one thing that we should talk about is the no-slip condition. So that is one of the first places where you start to see breakdown of continuum assumptions. So you lose this what's called the no-slip condition. Well, actually, the no-slip condition doesn't really have a physical basis in fluid mechanics. It's a boundary condition of convenience. It's the one that we've been using since about the late 1800s. Prior to that, it was a big debate in the fluid mechanics community what the proper boundary condition was. The first boundary condition, and the one that actually, in hindsight, is most accurate, was proposed by Navier in 1836. And what he proposed was that the velocity of the fluid immediately adjacent to the wall, and that's what I'm writing out here, is the velocity of the fluid immediately adjacent to the wall should be related to the derivative of the flow profile at the wall, the derivative of the velocity field at the wall, because that is somehow proportional. That's proportional to the shear stress in the fluid. So the amount of force that the flow can exert on the wall, or the wall can exert on the flow, is related to the gradient of the fluid, gradient of the velocity. But then you have units of velocity here, and units of velocity over length, so units of inverse time there. So that can't you can't do that. So you need to put something that's got units of length back on. So Navier threw on this some length scale, LS. So let's take a look at what LS actually means. If I talk about flow in between two parallel plates, which is what's shown in this figure. So I have two parallel plates that look like that, and think about them being relatively close together. And I've got one plate's moving to the right at a speed big U. So if I take a look at Navier's boundary condition, if this separation distance between the two plates, let's call it H, if that separation distance between the two plates is relatively large compared to the molecular length scale, this LS is going to be approximately zero. It's going to be zero because I'm looking at it from far enough away that I don't see any kind of velocity slip. And so what I see if in a macroscale flow, what I generally see is that at the lower wall, the velocity is zero, and at the upper wall, the velocity is exactly big U. Okay, so that's called the no-slip condition, and that's an approximation that we've been using for a long time and quite successfully. Now, if you zoom in close enough that the molecular nature of the fluid starts to become apparent, you run into a phenomenon called flow slip, where the flow slips along the boundaries. And Navier's boundary condition accommodates that. So what that looks like is because the governing equations of the fluid mechanics tell you that the velocity profile in this case has to be linear. So even if the flow slips along the walls, the velocity profile is still linear. But the intercepts change. So what happens is instead of the velocity going to zero at the bottom wall, it goes to zero somewhere outside of the bottom wall. And it still goes to U, but not at the top wall. It goes somewhere outside the top wall. And the interpretation of LS is LS is the distance outside of the flow at which you finally reach the speed of the boundary. And I've drawn it in this case. I've drawn these two LSs different. Generally, they'd probably be the same, but if the bottom wall and the top wall are comprised of different materials or different temperatures, they could certainly be different. All right. So that's an aside. That's just an explanation of the slip boundary condition, and that's one thing that computational people have observed. So I'll show you a couple of molecular dynamics simulations here. And the first is flow between parallel plates. So this is basically what we looked at in the previous slide. And these were experiments that, well, let's say numerical experiments that were done at ETH in Zurich, which is also coincidentally happens to be the place where they invented the atomic force microscope. But what you're looking at here is a carbon bottom wall and a carbon top wall. The bottom wall is stationary, and the top wall is moving along at 100 meters a second. Oops. Top wall is moving along at 100 meters a second. Let's see if I can get that back on. And now what you should try to do with your mind on this while you're looking at this is try to integrate. So look at a particular region of the flow and integrate what you see the average molecule doing. And this should tell you how complicated the problem is, because you can't really tell what the average molecule is doing. In fact, they did a little computational trick here, which is they have a moving frame of reference that moves with the average speed of the fluid. And what you end up seeing then is just the noise, basically, of the molecules vibrating around. So your eyes are really bad at extracting what the velocity profile looks like here, in part because you need to look at something, you need to average over something like a million molecules to get rid of thermal noise. So if you do that, an average over a million molecules, you get something that looks like this. This is taken from a conference paper. This was Nanotech 2003, and it's not plotted really well. So I had to rotate the figure relative to the animation. But what I'm plotting is velocity as a fraction of the top plate speed as a function of the distance I am between the top and the bottom plate. And you can see here that that distance is something in the vicinity of 4 nanometers. So that's something like 12 molecular diameters in between the two. And what the flow looks like is, so if this were a continuum flow and the no-slip condition applied, I would expect to see a curve that looks like that. And I don't see anything at all like that. I see a curve that's slightly inclined in the direction that the no-slip condition would predict, but only very slightly. And so then if I extended this, the flow profile, down until it actually hit zero, I would get the slip length. And similarly, if I extended it up until it hit one on this chart, or big U in a dimensional representation, I could get the slip length on that surface. And it turns out, I mean, you can tell that it's really far away. It turns out that those slip lengths are something on the order of 14 to 63 nanometers, depending on the operating conditions. So 63 nanometers, that is almost 1,000 molecular diameters. It is 1,000. No, it's just over 100. It's a couple hundred. So it's something like a couple hundred molecular lengths, which means in terms of the scales of this flow, you could think of it in terms of this height, which is 4.5 nanometers. It's considerably larger than that. It's considerably larger than the molecular length scale as well. Okay, so that would tell us, and maybe that's not unexpected, because what it's saying is that when you're talking about a 4-nanometer flow, you get discontinuous behavior. All right, so that no shocker there. But we can consider another example, and the next example is flow around a carbon nanotube. So this is a carbon nanotube that has almost exactly the same dimensions as the previous separation between the parallel plates that we talked about. But instead of being an internal flow, it's an external flow. And instead of the flow being parallel to the carbon plates, the flow is actually stagnating at the carbon nanotube. Okay, so again, with your eyes, you can't see a whole lot of what's going on there. But if you do, if you do the same kind of thing that we talked about in the beginning here, and you average over small regions of space and come up with the average velocity, and then plot that, what we're going to look at is the average velocity. So here's my carbon nanotube. We're going to look at the average velocity as I move away from the carbon nanotube along that line. And I'm going to plot it as position along that line. So that in both of these plots, that position is little r minus big R. Big R is the radius of the nanotube. So then this plot should go from zero at the surface of the carbon nanotube to whatever as I move farther away from it. So let's look at the left-hand figure first. The left-hand figure, the reason that they did this simulation is that there's a well-known theory for how the flow should behave. in fact, this is one of the solutions that we do very early on in ME509, which is our introductory graduate fluids class. This gives me a way to calculate the slip length in this relatively complicated arrangement. And so what they did was they plotted the flow along this vertical line, and that is the jaggedy values that you see here. And then they fitted the known solution to it. And once you have a known solution, then you can interpolate down to where that known solution goes to zero. And then that's the distance between where the solution goes to zero and the actual wall location tells you the slip length. Okay, and in this case, you can see the slip length is really small. So this axis is given in nanometers, and you can see that the slip length is something like a tenth of a nanometer. And so that's smaller than the molecular diameter. It's considerably smaller than the previous case. And these two lines, the two lines there, they're just different operating conditions. But what you can see is these are chemically identical situations. In one case, I've got water between carbon plates. In the other case, I've got water flowing over a carbon cylinder. So they're chemically identical, but they're mechanically different. The orientation of how the fluid molecules interact with the wall is different. And so you can't, just from knowing the chemical, let's say the chemical behavior of the system, you can't predict what's the right fluid boundary condition. And so that's very puzzling, and it means that you probably need to do the molecular approach. You probably need to take a molecular approach in solving these problems if you're at all anywhere close to the line that separates the molecular world from the continuum world, because you just don't know what the right boundary condition is. Even more troubling, or let's say another troubling fact, is the left-hand figure predicts that the slip lengths are very small, but the right-hand figure, for the same operating conditions, shows that even though the velocity field behaves continuously, the density doesn't behave at all like we'd expect. And so the density, you see, initially the density starts out with a region that's devoid of molecules, and then the density jumps up very high to a value of 3, so 3 grams per cubic centimeter. That's about 3 times the density of water, what you'd expect the density of water to be. And then it drops down, and then up, and then down, and a couple little squiggles here. And what's going on is the water molecules are acquiring a preferred orientation. And that preferred orientation allows them to stack, just like ice crystals. And so that wasn't the goal of this paper. But at the same conference, I saw a talk by Narayan Aluru, his group at the University of Illinois. They did a little experimental or a molecular dynamics study of flow through carbon nanotubes and looked at this preferred orientation phenomenon. They looked at nanotubes ranging from 3/10 of a nanometer up to about 2 nanometers. And they looked at the situation where you would have a high pressure here on the top and a low pressure at the bottom. And so flow through this. This is basically a pipe, right? It's basically a tiny, tiny pipe. And so if I look at, so if I consider the first case, the 3/10 of a nanometer, those nanotubes are just the size of a molecule. And the 2 nanometer case, those are, something like 8 molecular diameters across. So if I look at the flow through the nanotube, in the case, the leftmost case, where the diameter is very small, I essentially get molecules going through one at a time. And if I push one in, one comes out the other end. And you can't really call that a fluid flow, because it's more like it's just one at a time. If I go and look at the rightmost case, where there's something like 8 or so molecular diameters can stand in between the walls of the nanotube, you see that there's really no preferred orientation for the molecules in that situation. They acquire a random orientation. Okay, that's fine. That's what you'd expect in a macroscale flow. In the middle, however, where there are something, that's the 8/10 of a nanometer case, there's something like 3 molecular diameters across the nanotube there. There you can see some orientation effects. And so if you look at the molecules that are immediately adjacent to the wall, you see that they all have the same orientation. So you see the oxygen, then a hydrogen, then an oxygen, and a hydrogen, and an oxygen, and a hydrogen. They're all lined up in a preferred orientation. And so in molecular dynamics, you can do great flow visualizations. So what they did was did a cross-section through the nanotube and looked at that. So this is this guy here is a side view, and the bottom figure is a top view. And so this is looking down the pipe. And looking down the pipe, you see a hexagonal structure. And that hexagonal structure is like ice. That's the same crystal structure that you see for ice. So this is a liquid water, but it is it has the non-random orientation, the crystallographic structure of ice, which is very puzzling because, you know, on one side it behaves like a liquid. You push it through the nanotube, it behaves like ice, and then it comes out on the other side and behaves like a liquid. So this is just computational right now. There are groups looking at trying to confirm or deny whether this actually happens. So I think it does. There have been some initial results that make it look like this is actually what happens. All right, so that is, I'd like to finish this up with a little bit of a talk about what we do in our lab, experimental velocity measurement. And start this off with what can you do at nanometer length scales? And really the state of the art in terms of length scale is transmission electron microscopy. And so this is a picture of water stuck in a carbon nanotube, and the transmission electron microscope can image almost to individual atoms in this case, and you can see the water at these small length scales. Now this is still a novelty, I guess. You can't really do any good science with this. It's a complicated, the liquid that's in there is a complicated mixture of carbon and water and maybe some other solvents. And it's under these strange conditions of being hit by an electron beam. But in any case, I think this holds some promise for the future in terms of doing nanometer scale measurements. Now, what we do is more on the micron length scale, although we're getting to the sub-nanometer range. We do measurements of flows on micron length scales. The way that we do that is we use a technique called microparticle image velocimetry, which uses a laser beam, and the laser shines into our flow. So our flow is shown up at the top of the image here. The laser shines into the flow, and we have small particles that are carried by the fluid. Those particles absorb the laser light, and they fluoresce. They absorb the green light, and they fluoresce red. And the red light comes back to a scientific-grade CCD camera. Once we take two or more pictures of these particles, we can then infer how they're moving. So this is a technique that's been around. Well, actually, it's been around since Prandtl did some work in particle tracking, but it's been a very popular technique since about the mid '80s. The micro version of it was invented by us in the late '90s, and is currently patented and licensed to a company. And so you can buy these turnkey systems. If you want to do this kind of thing, but don't want to get all balled up in the details of how to do it. So to take a closer view of what's going on here, the microscope objective comes in from the bottom, and the laser light comes out of the microscope objective, illuminates the flow. The flow has to be seeded with small particles, so we add these in generally, although you can use particles that happen to be naturally occurring. Those particles, they absorb the green light, and they fluoresce red, and the red comes back toward the microscope objective. Now, you can see some problems here. For instance, the focal plane has some particles in it. Those particles show up as round white dots on my camera, but there's lots of particles that are in the same field of view, but in front of or behind the focal plane, and so those are blurred out. very quickly, but they do increase the background signal to noise. They decrease the signal to noise ratio. So here's another picture of how this all fits together. Once I have a pair of images, so I take at least two images. I can do this with a thousand or a million images, but I need at least two in order for this to work, because then I have a before and after shot of where the particles were and where they have gone to. Then I can use correlation methods to analyze the image, to analyze where the particles have gone. And once I do that, then I can produce a spatially resolved measurement of what the velocity field looks like in the flow. So here's a picture of these particles in a supersonic microthruster. The thruster is indicated by the white lines around the edge of the around the black edge of the nozzle, and you can see the background glow. You can see individual particle images. Those are the white dots, but you can also see this background glow that I was talking about. And that's what puts an upper limit on how many particles we can put in these flows. So the way that we figure out what the velocity, what the flow is doing, is quantitatively. We chop the flow up into small sub-blocks, which we call interrogation regions, and we statistically analyze what the particles in each of those interrogation regions is doing. And we do that hundreds or thousands of times, and we can get a spatially resolved view of the flow. So this is one of the first flows we did, which was flow in a rectangular capillary. And you can get, if you look at what one measurement is doing compared to the next, that gives you an idea of the noise level. And you can see that this is relatively low noise level. But the important thing is, let's skip that. So we do have to worry about wall-particle interactions. But as long as you're 10 particle diameters away from the wall, that's something that we don't really have to worry about. The main results of that measurement, the flow measurement that I just showed you through a rectangular capillary, is that we can measure the velocity with about 2% accuracy, 2% of full scale. And here's this corner right here is where the agreement is least accurate. And the red line is the analytical solution, and the diamonds are row-wise averages of the previous velocity field. So this is the thing that tells you that you can do this. We've done a number of flows. We took a look at flow around a red blood cell. And so the red blood cell is right here in the center. This is a white light image of the red blood cell. And you can see the flow splitting and going around the blood cell. This cell happens to be stuck to a plate, but we are actually in the lab. We're currently getting ready to do these sorts of measurements on free-floating cells. And then you can calculate things like shear stress. What's a shear stress? How does the cell rotate in response to a shear stress? You can do all kinds of neat things if you can do this on the fly. Working with the University of Colorado, we've measured flows around a micro fan. So this is a micro fan side view here. It's an electrostatic micro fan. It's driven at resonance at about 12,000 hertz. And it drives a flow. Now, what I have up here in the upper right figure is basically flow visualization. So there's small particles that are being carried along by this flow that's driven by the fan. One thing I should point out is that this picture in the upper right is opposite orientation of the sketch in the lower left. So you see it moving fluid this way, when this sketch here tells you it should be moving that way. Just a problem with the... We didn't want to have to flip the images, so that's the way we printed them or saved them. The actual cantilever is down here in the background noise, which you can't see. But you can see the effects of the cantilever, and you can see that it's pulling in fluid and spitting it out. And that's kind of what you'd expect from a fan in this situation. Now, and so that's flow visualization. That's qualitative. PIV, micro PIV, makes this quantitative. And so the fan is down here again. And you can see it's pulling in fluid that way and ejecting it out that way. And the thing that you can do, the reason you want numbers for this is, let's say this is a cooling fan that's supposed to be near a hot spot in an integrated circuit. I can draw a line here and integrate the mass flow across that line. And that would tell you, would give you an indication of how much heat this flow could carry away from the hot spot. Or I could integrate momentum across here and figure out how much thrust it could develop and use it as a thruster. Let's see. The one last thing I'd like to finish up with then is one advanced application of microparticle image velocimetry is microparticle image thermometry, or measuring diffusion. Diffusion is related to temperature. And the way that we do that is by looking at the breadth of our correlation peak. So we use, we use statistical methods to measure what the average particle is doing and construct a velocity field. If we have a hotter flow or a flow in which there's, for some other reason, more diffusion going on, we'll see this is a case, the left figure is a case where there's less diffusion, and the right figure is a case where there's more diffusion. And you just see a broadening of the correlation peak. And I can relate that broadening of the correlation peak to a diffusion coefficient. And so using this equation, the S squared is the standard deviation of the correlation peak. And I can relate it to the diffusion coefficient, which is given here, through an equation that Einstein developed a little over a century ago. And so once I know things like the, let's say the particle diameter, the viscosity, I could determine either the diffusion coefficient or temperature. And we've used this to do both. So I've got a few simple examples here. If we use this to do temperature, we can get accuracies of about plus or minus, well, this shows 3 degrees C. We've been able to do better than that since then. So plus or minus 3 degrees C, this figure here is plotting a thermocouple temperature, so let's call that a known temperature, versus PIV measured temperature. So plus or minus 3 degrees isn't something you get too excited about if you were buying a lab-grade thermometer, but this is plus or minus 3 degrees on potentially micron-sized spots. So that's the big selling point of this technique. So that was temperature. We can also use this as a virus detection or a biological detection system by measuring diffusion coefficient and looking for it when the diffusion coefficient of a known size particle changes. So what we did in these experiments was we functionalized a polystyrene latex particle and then functionalized it against a virus called an M13 virus, which is a canine virus. And once the particle is functionalized against that virus, if it comes into contact with that virus, the virus sticks to it. And so the polystyrene latex ball looks like you dropped it on the carpet. Right? It looks like a sucker dropped on the carpet. It's got all kinds of fuzz stuck on it. That fuzz is going to slow down how fast the particle can move in response to Brownian motion. And that is decreasing its diffusion coefficient. That's equivalent to decreasing the diffusion coefficient. So if you look at the right figure, I've plotted the number of viruses per particle here as a function of frictional resistance. Well, don't worry too much about what frictional resistance is. Just think of that as the denominator of the diffusion coefficient. And what you see is that as the number of viruses per particle goes up, I have roughly linear behavior. Very nearly linear behavior. I have an R squared value of 0.983. And so what this tells me is I can say based on the motion of this particle, how many viruses are attached to it. So that's, and now the important thing here is I can do this with big viruses, or I can do it with small viruses. I can do it with viruses that are smaller than the wavelength of light, which means viruses that you couldn't otherwise see, you can do this with. So it's a useful technique. Nanoscale velocity measurement. So the next, the topic that we're currently working on is to take microparticle image velocimetry, which has spatial resolutions of microns generally, on the order of single microns, to take that down to hundreds of nanometers. And the idea is to look at individual pixels. Instead of using the interrogation regions that I mentioned before, which are a larger collection of pixels, say 8 by 8 or 32 by 32 pixels, use individual pixels. Now, one problem is that particles behave differently when they get near walls. So if you look at any of these columns of vectors, what you'll notice is that all of the vectors are pointed horizontally far from the wall, but when you come down near the wall, the vectors become inclined away from the wall. So down in here, they get inclined away from the wall. So that's called shear-induced migration, and it happens when the particles get very close to the wall. That causes a problem in that you're measuring the particle is not doing what the fluid is doing. So we imagine the fluid is moving horizontally here, but the particle is moving somewhat vertically. So fortunately, two things. If I'm outside of about 10 particle diameters from the wall, this isn't a big deal. And even if I'm closer to the wall, the particles behave in a known manner. So they move away from the wall in a known manner and relatively slowly. So if you compare the magnitude of this vertical velocity to the maximum horizontal velocity, it's very small. It's a very small fraction. I say here we must disregard particles within about 10 particle diameters of the wall or incorporate a model to account for wall effects. The second thing that happens if I try to do this on very small length scales, let's say if I try to do this in carbon nanotubes, is that diffraction starts to become a problem. So if I imagine doing this, the kind of thing we do now, let's say we do this in a 500 micron channel, I would use particles that are about 1% of the channel diameter. So that gives me something like a 5 micron particle. We actually don't use particles that big. We use maybe up to about a micron. But let's say roughly a 1% of the channel diameter is what we usually use. And so when I image those particles in the channel, they would look like this. I would see a bunch of particles distributed through the channel. Now, if I scaled this down to a 500 nanometer channel, so that's a factor of 1,000 smaller, I would have I have a 500 nanometer channel. I would like to use particles that were about 1% of that, so that would be 5 nanometers. And the particles could be distributed in space just like they are in the micro channel case. But if I try to image them with light, what they look like is this, because each particle has a diffraction pattern associated with it, and that diffraction pattern is about the wavelength of light. Well, this 500 nanometer channel is about the wavelength of light. So I don't see anything. But one way to get around this is to greatly reduce the concentration of particles. And if I do that, if I greatly reduce the concentration of the particles, then I'll get, so I have one particle there and one particle there. The diffraction pattern is what's called an unbiased estimator of the particle location. So if I see this diffraction pattern, I know that the particle's at the center of that pattern. And as long as I have enough time to wait to collect images of enough particles going through there, I can do particle image velocimetry at nanometer length scales. So the ultimate floor on this technique is something like 60 nanometers. That's about the smallest spatial resolution that we can get. And we are currently working on demonstrating that. So the proof that this can be done is a group in Holland did this 2 years ago. But they weren't really thinking about nanoscale measurements. They were just measuring relatively large micron scale flows. And so they were using half micron particles and looking at them with a 20x lens. And this, the particles are pretty big in that case, and the lens magnification is pretty small. But the important thing is, this is also out of my book. If I take a look at a lens that has those characteristics and look at the particle size, this thing that's circled here, 1.34, that's the size of the diffraction-limited spot size in for the parameters that they used. And so it's 1.34 microns. Now, they did measurements and found that the spatial resolution that they were able to achieve with these low magnification lenses and big particles, the spatial resolution was about one-third of this spot size. About one-third of the spot size. So they were at about 500 nanometers. So they were able to get 500 nanometer accuracy, which is beating the diffraction limit by a factor of about 3. So this gives us, this is why we have confidence that we can do this at nanometer length scales. So just a very tiny conclusion here. Be careful of using the word nano in fluid mechanics, or at least nanofluidics. Whenever you use nanofluidics, it should be, you should use it when nano is the reason that the flow changes in behavior, not just that it's small. And what's really more appropriate in fluid mechanics, although you don't get funding based on using these adjectives, is to use continuum and subcontinuum. Those are the adjectives that really tell you what's important in fluid mechanics. Okay, that's it. That's the end. So anybody have any questions?
Yeah.
So your velocity profiles look sort of continuum in the last example that you showed us.
Yeah.
But what are the consequences for things like shear stress, heat transfer rate, et cetera, because of all the density wiggle you have?
Yeah. That's a good question. So, yeah, you would have oscillations in shear stress as well. You know, so your velocity is continuous, and you take derivatives of that, and something like kinematic viscosity would be continuous, but dynamic viscosity would have the wiggles in it, and so you would have gradients in force.
I mean, just in terms of the mass flow near the wall, it's much lower or much higher depending on how this volume is happening. And so does anybody look at those kinds of transport? I mean,
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, the problem is a lot of this work is funding agency driven, and you're trying to answer one particular problem, which is, you know, some case of flow through a nanopore, and you get your results and you go on. And people largely don't have the opportunity to do the nice wide-ranging study of what is the right boundary condition. So I haven't seen anybody do that yet. I've been able to put together pieces of snapshots from other people's stuff, but nobody's. Some of these MD guys should be able to take a good shot at that, and I haven't seen that paper yet.
Yeah, so because the whole idea of heat transfer from CNT submerged in liquid and so on is a lot of interest. I mean, pipes and thermal interface things and so on. And
yeah.
All kinds of funny behaviors in the world, and that's of interest.
Yeah, I think that people have done looked at heat transfer, and but they nobody's yet, and there's interesting temperature boundary conditions as well. So somebody needs to do the service to the community, and you know, it would be a great paper, right? I mean, if you were the one to put that paper out, it'd be cited for years. So and I meant you in a general sense, but you in particular, yeah. There's something for you to work on. Yeah.
In your MD simulations that you showed us,
yeah,
you have the length scale as let's say a few let's say tens of molecular time degree.
Yes.
Now, is there we can also apply split boundary conditions within continuum theory.
That's right.
And then, so what is the thing that allows us to use split boundary conditions on both the models, like in MD simulations and in continuum models? But the limit, or in other words, what limit you start using sleep lengths or molecular dynamics?
Yeah, actually, so here's so one comment on that question. There is no boundary condition input into the molecular dynamics. The molecular dynamics starts from a model of how the molecules interact and then a model of the, you know, second Newton's second law. And from that, we get this slip boundary condition. So that is support that the slip boundary condition is appropriate. So the issue of whether that's the appropriate boundary condition, you know, so what you would do is if you wanted to look at flow through a nanopore or something, and you wanted to come up with a simple reduced order model, you would do your molecular dynamics of the flow through that pore, figure out what the boundary condition looked like, and it may be the slip boundary condition that we talked about. It may be something more exotic. It depends on it depends on chemically what you're talking about. And then you would use that model in some kind of continuum sort of calculation, some kind of reduced order calculation, because you don't always want to be doing this molecular dynamics. This stuff's really expensive. So you come up with some kind of reduced order model, and that would include something about the continuum behavior, or about the statistical behavior of the fluid, as well as about the boundary condition. So you would, in this case, what I've showed you, the slip length happened to be the right way to talk about it. This stuff was consistent with Navier's results, but it wouldn't have to be.
So are you saying that the slip length is a trick to match molecular dynamics to a continuum model?
Well, it's a proposed model, and it happens to be a model that's been tested quite a bit and seems to be pretty applicable. So I wouldn't say trick. I'll roll my sleeves up a little bit so you can see there's no tricks here. But it is just a model and not always the right one. I don't know if that got to what you were asking. I mean, it is, in fact, this kind of stuff that I showed today. If you're talking about flow in a meter scale water runoff pipe that's flowing into the Wabash, you get the same kind of behavior. You get this slip flow very near the boundary, but nobody notices it because that slip length is, even if it's 60 nanometers like we talked about, who cares inside of a 1 meter pipe? So I don't know if that got it. Other questions?
More questions? And then thanks, Professor.
All right, thank you.